Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
From KCRW, this is Greater LA. It's the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Together, LA's two juvenile halls house 370 incarcerated youths at facilities downtown and in Sylmar. The numbers there have fallen sharply since 2020 by more than half, partially as a result of California's rethinking of juvenile justice. But the young people who remain face dire conditions, lockdowns, frequent fights and violence, limited access to learning and recreation, even to their parents or attorneys. The LA County Probation Department, which oversees the halls, claims they need more resources, more officers. They say the situation is so bad, workers are leaving their jobs in droves. And those advocating and speaking on behalf of the youth say that's making for a vicious cycle. Fewer staff members, more chaos, more lockdowns, or similar. LA Times reporter James Quealy has written an extensive piece about the crisis at juvenile halls, and he's with us right now to talk about it. James, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Your article starts with the story of a jarring, chaotic scene in a juvenile detention center, and then there are more violent and disturbing stories told by the people inside. What are they saying is happening there, and who are they saying it to?
So by and large, the situation on the ground in the juvenile halls, and this goes back to March, some would argue longer than that, is that you simply do not have enough officers in Central and in Sylmar to properly just affect day-to-day care of young people. You know, people, there are not enough officers for there to be schooling, there are not enough officers to be recreational activities, you know, getting outside, that kind of thing, just running around, things kids do, whether they're in a carceral setting or not. And it's kind of turned everything into a tinderbox. You know, you have people, you have kids just fed up, you have activists, advocates saying the kids have nothing to look forward to, they're pent up, they're not, you know, getting out of small areas, and when they do, you know, tempers flare and fights are quick to happen. You've seen, you know, the data from the probation department shows there have been more fights between youths as of, I believe the data I had was by early October, there have been more fights between youths this year than all of last, and more assaults on officers by youths than all of last year, and that was with 3 months to go. So you've got, you know, people getting hurt, people breaking bones, and it's all coming back to the staffing crisis.
Your report actually cites a lot of data. 40%, only 40% of the juvenile hall staff are considered able to, quote, physically interact with inmates, while another 27% are on leave or light duty. I mean, what explains this massive shortage?
The department has been under a hiring freeze, or at least it's been under a hiring freeze as it relates to juvenile positions. As you know, the probation department also deals with adult probationers. Since the beginning of the pandemic, what's been happening, you know, people have gotten injured on the job and taken long-term leave. In other cases, you've had resignations. Something around 130 people have left the agency over the course of this year. Some of that was retirement, but a lot of it was injury-related, was related to the chaotic situation. You know, I talked to one longtime officer in that story, said he had a friend on the job sometime around April or May, gets punched in the face, may have broken his nose, and just never came back. And there's a lot of stories like that. Officers, you know, they're in these undermanned positions. They get overwhelmed by youth, and they just get overwhelmed by the situation, and they don't want to come back, and they find other work, and the department is simply not able to replace them fast enough. So kind of same thing, you know, vicious cycle. The problems cause people to leave, and then they don't have enough people to deal with the situation on the ground during each shift, and then things get worse.
And I can imagine, I mean, that there's a lot of fallout for the people who are incarcerated at those juvenile facilities.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of, you know, really unpleasant stories about what's happening to the youths in there as well. You know, I spoke to a clinician at one of the halls, you know, somebody who deals, you know, really has a lot of knowledge of the mental health impacts on the individual youth. You know, they said they've seen patients that never exhibited self-harming behavior before now having suicidal ideations this year. There's one anecdote in my piece of a youth who, by the clinician's description, was generally mild-mannered, not in there for a violent crime, not a violent kid. Is staying at Central, and was informed of another lockdown and just had had enough and refused to go back to their room and was dragged off by 8 probation officers screaming. There was a physical interaction. I'm not exactly sure of the specifics, but ultimately the kid is banging his head against the door to his room, you know, over and over and over again. Well, his clinician is there, you know, by their description, unable to do anything, and officers are not getting involved. You know, I've just heard other stories of, you know, generally this, you know, the point of juvenile detention under California law is rehabilitation, not punitive. Yet kids aren't going to school because either education employees themselves are afraid to go into the halls because of the chaos, or due to the staffing levels, the probation department can't legally allow classes to take place. You've got kids, some of them with learning disabilities, left in a room to do a workbook and not gain anything from it. Like I said, I talked to one kid who was, you know, he described being held in about 5 different lockdowns at Central going back to the summer, you know, said he's, again, just stuck in a box all day, not able to communicate with anybody, not able to really do anything of meaning, and even, you know, sometimes not able to get access to a bathroom in expedient times, that he didn't feel like he was being treated like a human being while in juvenile custody in L.A. County.
There is more use of force that's been going on there. Pepper spraying, right? You mentioned that in your article, pepper spraying by officers. Attacks on officers as well. What are you hearing from them?
The officers are extremely frustrated. They think whether it is by the Board of Supervisors or the state board that has some oversight, the department itself, the media, that they are always painted as the villains being abusive toward kids. And the probation department does have a bad reputation in this area. You mentioned pepper spray. A number of officers were prosecuted but ultimately not convicted for assault a couple of years back for the way they used pepper spray on youths. There were a couple of county inspector general reports back in, I believe, 2018 detailing, you know, the way spray was used as a threat. In some cases, kids were being sprayed back in the day and not then properly, you know, given a chance to decontaminate or wash it out of their eyes or their mouths. And, you know, that was basically, you know, prolonged pain issue. The department is supposed to phase out the use of pepper spray. It is basically one of the highest levels of force they are legally allowed to use on kids in custody, but it just has not happened. You know, the state Department of Justice has an oversight role in this, but it has not been properly phased out yet. I believe, I don't have the data in front of me, but I believe I reported that the use of spray basically effectively quadrupled this year. And then, yeah, you've got, you know, increases in overall force, use of soft restraints, use of physical restraints, physical blows on the kids. And this is happening more also because of the staffing issue again. You know, we've got multiple anecdotes in that story. I've heard multiple anecdotes from officers that they end up in these situations where there's a fight between 8, 10, 12, 14 kids, and there's only one of them. And basically, as a crowd control device, they will disperse the OC spray that the county doesn't want them to, the chemical spray rather, the pepper spray that the county doesn't want them to use.
I just want to make it clear, though, because, you know, the probation department claims it's a lack of funding. Your report says a lot of people are calling in sick. And in fact, you note that the budget has actually increased, even while the number of incarcerated youth has fallen by more than half since I mentioned since 2020. So this really is, I don't want to come to work.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is going to shock you, but police agencies and police unions often ask for more money as the answer to every problem.
Right.
So that is not exactly a shocking turn of events here. The general argument is that this is a blue flu situation to some extent, that the officers are refusing to come to work out of, you know, not in a, I guess blue flu is unfair because that's, you know, generally connotes to a protest situation where it's
fear is real,
are legitimately afraid, and there are, you know, it's not that they are overblowing this. You know, I've written about issues of, like I said, officers suffering broken bones. An officer fell through some kind of tarp or skylight on a pool complex back in February. The concerns about manpower and about physical disparity between some of the officers and the youths are very real. I don't mean to diminish the situation the probation officers find themselves in, but the issue by and large is not staff vacancies, it's staff not coming in. There are vacant positions, certainly. The department is not fully staffed as to what it is funded. But the main frustration by everything I can look at is that officers who are on the payroll not showing up.
The state of California has decided to shut down, you know, its remaining juvenile detention centers next year, which, you know, follows years of complaints of abuse and calls for alternatives, obviously, to youth imprisonment. I mean, is that one? I mean, what are the solutions, James, going forward? What does the state say is a solution? What does LA County say is a solution?
The department keeps referring to what it says is the LA model. I don't honestly understand what that is. It hasn't been well explained. If you talk to more advocates in this space, you know, they talk about a, you know, countywide plan called Youth Justice Reimagined, which would be, like you mentioned, you know, kind of an alternative to incarceration, trying to make focus everything more towards a rehabilitative or reform lens. You mentioned the Division of Juvenile Justice closing down at the state level. I believe by mid-2023, all those facilities will close. And that's a big concern locally because most people in DJJ are there for violent crimes. They might still have time left on their sentences. And, you know, we're probably talking about less than 50, less than 60 kids, but those people will be coming back to the juvenile halls that are already in disarray with the current population.
James Quealy writes about crime and policing for the LA Times. Thanks for coming on, James, and thanks for talking about this. I mean, it's a serious issue. There's a lot going on there, and I hope you'll keep us updated.
I will do my best to do that. Thanks for having me on.
Coming up on GLA, with World Cup soccer moving along now, look at how the world's most popular game finally made it to America and how youth soccer helped it along decades ago right here in Southern California.
We moved to Torrance. It was like moving to Disneyland. It was the best place in the whole wide world with a beach a mile away, and then soccer started in 1964.
The American Youth Soccer Organization has taken over nationwide as the place where kids play the game, but it started right here in Greater LA. That's yours after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. While professional soccer in the United States has been slowly growing and reaching mainstream popularity over recent decades, recreational soccer, especially for kids, has been huge for a long time. Weekend soccer games are practically a rite of passage for boys and girls of all skill levels all across the country. The culture even gave birth to a political interest group called Soccer Moms. Remember them? KCRW's Bob Carlson, host of the Unfictional podcast, brings you the latest in a series called Football Confidential that you're hearing this month as the World Cup competition continues. Today, a look at the place where the seeds of this American brand of youth soccer were planted, a place in the South Bay where it became so popular they called it Soccer City.
If you visit a park or school athletic field on a Saturday or Sunday in the fall, what you'll see is probably the best example of a truly homegrown American soccer culture. Kids from kindergarten and up, playing mostly on small fields with small goals. The sidelines are lined with parents fully invested in the game. And there will be orange slices at halftime. AYSO, the American Youth Soccer Organization, is where all of this started. It's nationwide, run mostly by parents and volunteers, and it was founded in Torrance in 1964. It's been an on-ramp for American kids to learn about soccer. And you can see how far youth soccer in LA has come since the early days of AYSO when you watch an intense workout with young players from the Los Angeles Football Club Academy on the campus of Cal State LA.
Yes, I'm Todd Saldana. I'm the academy director at LAFC.
Todd Saldana himself was once a talented youth player, and he's been a first-hand witness to the growth of soccer in Los Angeles. He was drafted out of South High School in Torrance by the old Los Angeles Aztecs of the North American Soccer League. He's been a coach at UCLA, Cal Poly Pomona, and Loyola, and now he runs the successful academy at LAFC. But he began by playing AYSO in Torrance just a few years after the league was created. And he played with some of the key figures in the development of the league.
Like Ziggy Schmid was one of my coaches, who was one of the early AYSO guys. Hans Sterley, who was one of the founders of AYSO, was a West Torrance guy. I grew up in South Torrance.
You'll hear more about Hans Sterley later, but Ziggy Schmid is a major figure in the development of youth soccer and a foundational part of the U.S. professional game, one of the winningest coaches in Major League Soccer. After he passed away in 2018, the MLS Coach of the Year trophy was named in his honor. But he started out on one of the earliest AYSO teams after his family arrived from Germany and moved into a house near Alpine Village, the German-themed shopping center off the Harbor Freeway in Torrance.
Yeah, Ziggy's dad lived across the street.
Oh, really?
So yeah, it was like that was our meeting spot. We would meet at Alpine.
Alpine Village is an unexpected landmark for South Bay soccer of the 60s and 70s. When I was growing up playing AYSO, a German store there was the only place in the area that sold soccer cleats.
Yeah, you could get the latest kicker magazine from Germany, and you could get, you know, soccer boots shipped in.
When I asked Todd Saldana, who I should talk to, about the early days of AYSO and soccer in the South Bay, he said I should talk to Maureen Cano.
Hi, I'm Maureen Cano, and everybody calls me Cano. I'm the head women's soccer coach here at Cal State Dominguez Hills. This is my crazy 39th season as a head coach.
He's had a long career as a player and coach, and he ran a soccer camp with the name that's sometimes associated with him, Mr. Soccer. He said that before 1964, soccer in L.A. was a game played almost exclusively by immigrants who brought the game here and played in their local communities. Kids would learn from their parents. But there weren't many places where a young American player could discover the game for himself.
South Bay was non-existent, but in L.A., a foreign father would have a ball out, and the kid would go to the Greater L.A. League, the Continental League, the Latin Leagues, and take their boy, and the men would play every Sunday.
The 1960s were a period of tremendous growth in the South Bay. People moved to the area from all over the country and the world to work in the aerospace industry that was centered there.
Torrance, Redondo Beach, Hermosa Beach, Manhattan Beach, all the way to Gardena, all the way to Palos Verdes, all the way to San Pedro, where I lived. In Torrance and Palos Verdes Boulevard, every one of the neighbors pretty much worked at one of the aerospace company. And we moved to Torrance. It was like moving to Disneyland. It was the best place in the whole wide world with a beach a mile away. And then soccer started in 1964.
That's when German immigrant and graphic designer Hans Sterley and a group of businessmen created AYSO. But even before that, when Sterley's sons were small, he was almost like a Johnny Appleseed of soccer.
Mr. Sterley lived across from Jefferson Elementary. He would walk right out there with his little boys and roll a soccer ball out there and just say, this is soccer. And then we'd play a little soccer and he would explain everything. And a lot of us knew of it.
When he was 10 years old, Maureen Cano was walking through the neighborhood when he saw some kids he recognized.
And I looked over and I see these kids playing soccer, and I knew them from school. And one of the best athletes, Joe Girard, was out there with a couple guys I knew from class. So I saw him at class the next day. And he'd go, yeah, we signed up for this AYSO. It's soccer. It's just, it's fun. So I signed up.
At the time, it cost $5 to sign up, and there were no age categories. Costs can range up to $200 or $300 a kid nowadays. In the beginning, there were four Torrance teams, and Hans Sterley's wife brought the first orange slices.
They put me at forward, and I was offside every time and didn't know what the heck was going on. So our goalie didn't show up. They threw me in goal, and I dove for a ball, and everybody on the sideline cheered because they'd never seen anybody dive. They just stood there and blocked it, and I dove for it, and everybody cheered. And when everybody cheered me for once, instead of booing me for being offside every time, I stuck in there, and it's my whole career for my playing days.
Marine Cano was put on one of the original teams called the Panthers. He had a friendly rivalry with Ziggy Schmidt, who was on one of the other teams. But it was a rivalry that led to a long-standing AYSO league practice of remaking new teams every year, different teams of kids with different coaches. It's meant to keep super teams from forming.
Ziggy was a member of the dreaded firefighters. They were loaded. They had everybody. But the Panthers were really loaded. It was like club soccer. You don't disband. So the first year and the second year, first place Panthers, my team in second place was firefighters, Ziggy's team. But we would always fight who had the better team.
It's part of an AYSO philosophy that's more egalitarian than most youth sports leagues. Girls' teams were added in 1971, and they retain the motto, everyone plays. Every kid is guaranteed to play at least part of every game.
That motto, that everyone plays, is why I have a career. Because at the time, I was no specimen. I had no confidence. I was just learning the game. I listened. And what those coaches told me, I did.
At the time, soccer was not loved by everyone. Some Americans were suspicious of it, thought it was a sport for foreigners or communists. And AYSO soccer goals would sometimes get pulled down by angry neighbors who didn't want them on fields meant for baseball. But despite that, soccer continued to grow in popularity. And by the time the kids who'd started playing in AYSO entered high school, the South Bay had become a hotbed of American soccer, with big crowds turning up to watch the local Torrance rival schools.
The biggest games with Coach Eaton at West, who just passed on, versus South High School with Roger Bryant. And those games were insane. You know, they had 3,000 people at Spartan South High School in a league game, packed house. You know what the nickname for South Bay was? Soccer City. Everybody had called it Soccer City because we were way ahead of everybody. They had an all-star game at El Camino College, packed house at 8,000 people. It was the AYSO All-Stars versus Hanover, Germany.
Despite playing a team from a soccer country like Germany, the team from suburban Los Angeles held their own, losing only in the final moments. A teenage Marine Cano was playing in goal.
They scored in the last 5 minutes past Cano, broke through. I can remember thinking I got it, and then I went, okay, it's wide, and it went into the far side net, and they beat us 1-0.
In 1996, when Major League Soccer was established, one of the original teams was the LA Galaxy, and in what might be a testament to the Soccer City, since 2002, the team has been playing in the city of Carson, in the South Bay, where an American soccer culture was invented. For KCRW, I'm Bob Carlson.
By the way, you can hear a longer version of this story and listen to all of the L.A. soccer stories from the series Football Confidential at kcrw.com/unfictional. That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, soccer, of course, has grown big time in America. And as far as electronic sports go, we've come a long way from the old days of Pong. Esports on the high school schedule, where American football is king. We'll take you there tomorrow on Greater LA. Check us out online anytime at kcrw.com/GLA. Tell us what's happening in your world, your neighborhood. Maybe you have a story to share, would like to talk about one that we featured here on GLA. kcrw.com/GLA. Zeke Reed, Sonia Geis, Bob Carlson, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all helped put the episode together this evening. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great night.